Hello, and welcome to the Power Aqua podcast, a science podcast that shines a light on the newest and most interesting research being conducted in the fields of aquatic and marine ecology. My name is Joe Money. I'm a PhD student and the host of this podcast. Today, I'm joined by Kyle Cesar Perez de Paula, who's a researcher at both the Biology Center at the Czech Academy of Science and at the University of South Bohemia in the Czech Republic. We'll be discussing his research into the diversity of aquatic fungal assemblages and their role in the ecology of freshwater systems. Kyle, how are you doing?
Hi, Joey. Hi, everyone. Hi. I'm fine. Thanks for asking. How about you?
Yeah, not too bad. Not too bad. Just got back from some field work and settling back into life in the office and in the lab. So, yeah, doing okay.
Good.
So, Kyle, could you give us a quick summary of your background, your education, and your research history, just to educate the audience a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in a town outside of Brazil, nearby in São Paulo capital. I guess the most famous that people know about it. And when I turned 20, I moved to another city where I did my bachelor degree in biology. And it was in the Federal University of São Carlos. So at the university, I had my first contact with microbiology, and was when I decided to do my master and PhD in microbiology. And so when I finished my PhD there, after doing the master and PhD, so I was looking for some possibilities abroad, you know, to have contact with another research groups and new different methods or techniques. So I was looking for a postdoc. And that was the time that I found the research group here in Czech Republic. They are very known, and the Institute of Hydrobiology, to work with aquatic environments. So then I decided to move to Czech Republic.
Wow, it's a big change of lifestyle, I guess, from moving from Brazil to Czech Republic. Must have been a big step for you.
Yeah, you're right. It's a big change for cultural things. Also, the language is very hard for me. I'm still trying to learn Czech, but here in the institute we speak in English, so it's not a bad. But also, I had a very nice opportunities to be involved in other projects. You know, before in Brazil, I was getting my focus on microbiology in subterranean environments. And when I moved here to Czech Republic, I started to expand my field of work for other aquatic systems such as shallow lakes, rivers, streams, and reservoirs. So it was a good opportunity to be here.
Nice. And I have to commend you for trying to learn Czech, because as someone who's lived in Poland for a few years now, my Polish is very bad. And it's always a source of embarrassment. I'm sure Czech is quite difficult as well.
Yeah, is it?
Nice. What is it about microbiology and freshwater ecology in general that drew your attention and encouraged you to engage in further research in this area?
Well, to be honest, when I was a kid, I really admired this idea of scientists, you know, like the person working in the laboratory, wearing a lab coat, making new discoveries, and all these things was so impressive to me when I was a kid that I had this in my mind when I started to think about my profession. And I also have always been a very curious person, and I think this kind of characteristics what led me to the field of science. So I think both factors were very important for me to decide to be a scientist and researcher. And when I moved to the university for the bachelor degree, in the very first year, I became very interested in bacteria and fungi, especially after experiencing the practical lessons in the laboratory, you know, to be impressive, so tiny microscope organisms. And so I got very fan of this topic since the bachelor course. And then I met a group of speleologists, and they were always inviting me to start research fungi in caves. And you know, cave is a very suitable environment for fungi because more or less they have a the habitat has a stable temperature or it's a very humid environment. So they invited me to visit a cave for the first time. They were trying to encourage me to go to that field. So when I was visiting the cave at the first time, I realized that I had found myself in the field of ecology. And I was feeling so tiny person inside that huge subterranean environment and full of fungi. So it was very, very nice.
That's a really lovely story, and also something that I would never would have considered myself. I mean, a cave is a such a sort of a scary, almost like aseptic environment in my mind that I never really think about the sort of fungi that can live down there.
Yeah, but when you're there, like you think that how they all the organisms, fauna, microorganisms, they interact together to survive on that certain environment. I mean, not survive because that was it's the optimum environment for them. So it's a bit uncomfortable for us because we don't live on this kind of habitat. But when you think all the richness you have in this kind of environment is very, very interesting.
Yeah, that's very cool indeed.
But as I told you before, I start to work in a different project now in a different aquatic system. So, but for me, I understand that surface and subterranean environment are interconnected ecosystems at all.
Nice, that's great. So some of your current research focuses on the different modes of life in aquatic fungi. Could you explain to the listeners what modes of life means and maybe give some examples from your studies?
Yeah, sure. This is a very nice question. I would think something like when you are watching some these kind of Nat Geo documentaries that you have these kind of general questions: who are they and where they where what do they do or where do they live? And I think this is a kind of same way when we are thinking about these questions about fungi. So in aquatic environments, fungi can live as free living mode or be carried on into the aquatic system attached to some substrate. Although these terms are more applied to bacterial communities, we can define the fungi also as free living microorganisms when they are floating freely in the water column or swimming, because we also have some fungi that release zoospores, motile cells. And, but they also can be attached to some particles, soil particle, plant particles, and then they live fixed on this kind of substrate. And we also can categorize the aquatic fungi in relation of the mode of life or lifestyle. So fungi can be saprotrophs, for example, when the fungi obtain energy from the decomposition of organic matter. And this role play an important thing in the flow of carbon and nutrient into the system, especially when we are talking about complex organic matter like lignin or cellulose. But fungi can also be parasites of other organisms, such algae, invertebrates, or even vertebrates. And in this case, the fungus can be an obligate parasite when its own completes life cycle when it finds a host. Or can be a facultative fungi parasite when the organism can change its lifestyle according to the environmental conditions on the context. And also fungi can be active predators, like fungi can predate amoebas or small worms like nematodes. So we generally say that fungi are very versatile organisms and moving between these kind of lifestyles, if it's possible, of course. So fungal lifestyle interaction, I would say, is not static at all. And for example, we have the chytrids, one of the main groups that we know very well in aquatic systems, and other zoospore fungi. And they have one stage of the life cycle where the fungi is attached to the host, as so the fungi is a parasite, but they also have another moment in the life, another stage, where the fungus, in this case the zoospore cells, is swimming on the water column looking for an impost.
That's very well explained. Yeah, very well explained. I guess to put it in context for the listeners who might be more familiar with terrestrial fungi and other species like this, is that the saprotrophic fungi are the ones that are breaking down the dead and detritus matter of the environment, much like you would see a mushroom growing in the forest. And the parasitic fungi are the ones that are attaching and feeding off of other organisms in the water column, much in the way that, there are parasitic fungi in human life, like athlete's foot, for example. Would that be a good comparison?
Yeah, you are right. Like we know much more about the fungus in terrestrial environments, like soil or plant-associated microorganisms, and we also have the saprotrophs present on these kind of environments because the saprotrophs are very important to cycling carbon nutrients in any kind of environment. But we also have the parasites that are looking for some host to complete like the life cycle. Or can be the whole life cycle or just part of it when the organism take as much nutrient as possible from the host to survive and develop. And we also have the symbionts that I didn't talk about this before, but in like we have like a mycorrhiza fungi that are symbionts of roots of plants, but we also have some symbionts in aquatic systems, especially the ones living in the guts of some animals or invertebrates.
And could you just briefly summarize what you mean by symbiotic fungi?
When I'm talking about symbiotic fungi, symbiosis is our interaction, ecological interaction, where when you have a two organisms and they cooperate to each other, so both have benefits with this interaction. Symbiosis can be obligated as well, but some like a lichen, when you have a fungi associated with some algae or some bacteria, and this is obligate interaction for them. But we also have some symbiosis that is facultative, like the mycorrhiza fungi, when it's associated with the roots of the plant, it's an exchange of carbon and nutrients between plant and fungi, and both get benefits with it.
And this is an area of ecology that I think is really expanding at the moment, the understanding of these symbiotic relationships that are really present everywhere that we haven't really fully understood yet. Yeah.
Yeah, it's true.
So I understand that an important part of your research is the characterization and categorization of aquatic fungal species. Is there any opportunity in this role to perhaps discover new species? And if so, what environments are the most likely to contain these previously unknown organisms?
I would say that today we estimate like we have around 1.5 million species of fungi worldwide. But we know only about 3 to 5% of these species and that have been isolated and described. So I think looking for this percentage is clear that there are many other species that should be discovered, isolated, and described.
Wow, that's much less than I thought it was going to be in terms of how much we know about what's out there. I mean, 3 to 4% is what you said, right? Yeah, that's so low. And what jumps to my mind immediately from that is that fungi often have very interesting metabolisms, very interesting properties, very interesting lifestyles, and the applications that we could use from these organisms that we don't even know about yet in our lives, in our industry, in our medicine. It's almost hard to comprehend.
Yeah, you are right. Like the metabolism of fungi and all the applications that we can use these enzymes, for example, it's huge and we don't know too much yet. In relation to aquatic environment, this gap is even greater because over the last 100 years, a lot of research has focused on fungi in terrestrial environments, whether associated with soil or plants. And apart from it, fungi also were studied in medical issues. And it's clear the reason for this is the economic and health factor. But in recent years, I would say that the interest for fungi in aquatic systems has been growing a lot, mainly because we know that these kind of organisms play a crucial role in the flow of carbon and nutrients and have an incomparable enzymatic machinery, as you comment, and also can be a resource of other ecosystem services in different scales, you know? So I believe that the aquatic environment can be considered one of the most promising environments for discovering a new species of fungi. And the good point here is that we can check the methods and tools developed on the previous studies of fungi in soil, plants, or medical issues, and try to apply these kind of methods and tools in aquatic systems, or at least take some inspiration to develop a new method to increase our knowledge on our food.
Yeah, a lot to think about there, and a lot of potential, I'd imagine.
Yeah. But at the same time, we have some kind of conflict nowadays because we live in a time that is considered like an omic era, with virus genome tools for sequencing and whole genome sequence. And because of it, not many people are interested to study fungal taxonomy or using traditional cultivation methods to isolate and describe a new species. And the main reason here is that this whole process is very laborious and time-consuming, you know? So when you have like isolated and cultivated your fungi in the lab, you need to maintain this strain pure, I would say actinic, when you have just one organism on your culture, and you need to keep it alive for future studies, you know? And for that, you might need like a cultivation room, a cold room to keep the strain on low metabolism activity. And you also need some person to take care of all the strains and make some transfers time to time. So all the steps take time, and it's a bit more laborious when you're thinking about molecular methods.
Yep. And as someone who works with aquatic fungal parasites, I'm completely sympathetic with you there. It does take quite a lot of time and effort to keep these strains alive. but that actually leads me quite nicely onto my next question. Are you able to culture all the species that you sample from lakes, regardless of whether they're saprotrophic, parasitic, or free living? I'd imagine there's definitely some challenges involved in this process.
Yeah, it's true. A lot of challenges involved on the isolation of fungi in general, because not all microorganisms can be cultivated in the lab. And one of the main challenges in this area is trying to reproduce as close as possible the natural environment of the organism in the lab, you know, with the ideal conditions for the fungi to grow in another place or in a petri dish, for example. So although fungi are versatile organisms, as I said before, often certain species need some specific micronutrient, for example, that you need to know about it before to cultivate it in your lab, or the fungi can require some metabolite released by another species in the habitat, or some kind of specific environmental condition that you just realize when you get more familiar to the fungus that we are working on. So I would say that a lot of efforts have been done to isolate new fungal species, and we still need to motivate people to do that, because we have a lot of gaps in the database. So for example, when you work with sequencing methods, you basically need to go back to the database to identify your sequence for who organism that sequence belongs to. So when you don't have much information in the database about isolated fungi strains, you also cannot identify your sequence based on that. So it's kind of a complementary work, you know, the isolation methods and also the molecular methods.
Interesting, yeah. And as you mentioned earlier, there's a lot, it's a lot less laborious to do these molecular omics methods to characterize species, but I think the cultivation is just as important, even though it might be a bit more tricky.
Yeah.
So I've talked earlier about how we have a little bit of a overlap in our interests and our research, as I'm also studying fungal parasites. But one area in which our interests converge is something called the mycoloop. Now, can you explain to the audience what the mycoloop is and its impacts on the food chain and the flow of carbon, as you mentioned before, and also how it involves Daphnia, which is my study species?
Yeah, good question, by the way. So in aquatic systems, we have many organisms in the water column, and some of these organisms we call like a plankton. And among these organisms, we have bacteria, protists, fungi, and we have the phytoplankton and the zooplankton. Phytoplankton is basically the autotrophic components of the plankton community, and this can be like a green algae, diatom, cyanobacteria, while the zooplankton are these tiny animals present in the water column. So it's something more like a microinvertebrates, copepods, cladotherans, otifers. And also the fungi, it's included on this miscellaneous community, the water column. So go back to the parasites, fungal parasites. One of the common hosts of these parasites are the phytoplankton, especially for the chytrids. And an interesting and important fact here is that fungal parasites on plankton organisms, it's more like a rule rather than the exception. So it's very common, and there is some this kind of ecological link between them. So because most of the time we think that parasites is always bad interaction, but and the microloop shows us that it's not. So when the fungus, the parasite finds the phytoplankton as a host, the cell will attach to this phytoplankton cell wall and penetrate the cell. And inside the phytoplankton, the fungus takes nutrients and from the cell and begins to grow and then produce zoospores, another life stage of the chytrids that is a motile cell. So as the chytrid infection progresses in this phytoplankton, they cause some damage to the phytoplankton cell structures and integrity. So this kind of damage release small fragments of the cell or even break down the colonies and also release some organic matter and nutrients in the water. And these kind of materials become more readily available as a food source for zooplankton. So the zooplankton can then consume the released phytoplankton fragments and use the nutrients for their growth and reproduction. So this important process where the fungus can control the phytoplankton blooms, for example, and the fungus can also have a big role on to incorporate more palatable organic matter into the environment as a food source for zooplankton. And all this process is called mycoloop. But we also have the mycoflux. Have you heard about it?
No, I haven't. Please tell me more.
Because mycoloop is more related to autochthonous organic matter. So it's the organic matter that's already present into the aquatic system. But we also have the mycoflux, in which the fungi are also very important. Because think of with me, like aquatic systems can be considered as an endpoint effect. If you think that the soil particles, organic matter, detritus of plants from the terrestrial environment around, from the highest mountains to the valleys, they are washed, leached into the aquatic systems. So the aquatic fungi, actually, when meet these kind of particles, they can act to aggregate these kind of particles, and then these particles can be deposited at the bottom of the aquatic system, like in the sediment, so a kind of mineralization. Or the fungus can disintegrate, break down these particles into molecules that can be reintroduced to the aquatic system and used again, like a kind of carbon and nutrient pump. So
Oh, that's very interesting.
both methods, microloop and microflux, show the different process of aquatic fungi can transform and incorporate organic matter into the food web, and both processes are related directly to the flow of carbon and nutrient on the system.
And just one final point on this microloop and the microflux that you've been talking about. Both of these processes seem like they would be overall good for the quality of the water. For example, they're both talking about removing algal blooms or removing sedimentation. Is that part of the appeal of these fungal systems, where they almost help to improve the water quality?
Yes, this definitely is part of all the dynamics of we have in the aquatic system. Because if this system is healthy, it's because all these ecological interactions are good and equilibrate, balance. But when you have when you just put out some part of this interaction out of the system, you can create a cascade effect on all the trophic levels, I would say.
Yeah, very interesting indeed. So finally, we come to our last question, which I like to make a little bit more lighthearted. And we talked a little bit earlier about the possibility of discovering new species. And I'm sure that every scientist has imagined what it would be like to discover new species and what we would name them if we found one. Now, do you have any secret hopes to name a species after yourself or your hometown or something important to you? Dipolensis, perhaps, is the one that I came up with from your surname. What do you think about that?
I like this question. I think all scientists who's working with trying to describe new species always have some feeling about it. But especially for fungi, it's a bit difficult because we have many groups of fungi with sexual and asexual life stage. And this stage can be morphologically distinct. So if you look both stages, you would say that they are different organisms. But at the end, you just figure out that they are the same organism, but in a different stage of life. And because of it, many, many species are given two different names, in which two research groups describe the same fungus, but in different life cycles. So a lot of considerations must be taken into account when you are naming and describing new species, no? So after the steps to isolate, cultivate, and check the identity of your fungus, and you then describe this new species based on morphology, physiology, genetically. So the last step is to spread this information around the world. So it's recommended to publish the description with all this information that you can get from your new species in this peer-reviewed publication, these scientific journals. And then after you publish your work there, you need to wait for the next International Mycology Congress for the species should be validated and then included in the chapter organized by International Mycological Association. So it's some rules that it's more bureaucratic, but it's some way that avoid to have several names for the same organism, you know?
Does sound a lot less romantic than I made out, but a lot more bureaucratic, as you said. And it must be very gutting for you to discover a species, name it, and then realize that it's already been discovered. That must be a real kick in the teeth if that ever happens to someone.
Yeah, it's true. But then you can go for the more interesting part, that you need to choose a name for your new species, as you mentioned before in your question. And the name of a species, it's actually a combination of two words. The first being the genus, what that species belongs to, and the second word being the specific epithet. So the scientists and the researchers usually choose some unique characteristics of the organism for this specific designation. Or, for example, you can honor a great researcher in your field to name this species, or you just use a word that associates the species with the habitat in which it was found. So I have a kind of experience because during my master, when I was working in the caves in Brazil, I isolated a new species of fungi that I found in the sediment of the cave.
Oh, wow.
So the description is still in the final stage. We are submitting the paper and doing all these steps that I was mentioning before. It's more bureaucratic. But together with my colleagues and research group there, we decided to make a special reference to the place where the fungus was isolated. So this place is a very great speleological potential area, but still threatened by the advance of the agriculture in the region. So, as the cave where I isolate the fungi is located in the city called São Desidério, we decide to call this new species as Aspergillus desiderii, because desiderii
Nice.
will be a reference for the region.
Well, that's a lovely story. I'm very surprised as well that you had that story in your back pocket. And wow, very interesting indeed. But as you said, it sounds like you have to follow a few more steps than just naming it whatever you want.
Yes. But it's just, a regular thing that you need to follow the rules, and then you'll be published your species, and then the species is available because we also need to deposit the new species in at least two collection of cultures because the species should be public for everyone.
Well, that's a very interesting note to end on. And we have come to the end of the podcast now, but I just wanted to say thank you for being a great guest. And I really enjoyed chatting about aquatic fungal ecology with you. Yeah, thank you very much for coming on. And it was a pleasure to have you.
Okay, thank you, Joey, for to invite me to be part of this podcast. Congrats for your work on this Paraca podcast, and thank you everyone to listen this.
The Para Aqua podcast was funded by COST, the European Cooperation in Science and Technology, and is a product of the Para Aqua Action Group. If you are interested in joining an action group or just want to know more, please go to www.paraaqua-cost.eu or follow the link in the episode description. The podcast is produced by myself and Serena Rasconi, and the Science Communication Coordinator is Anna Gavrilovich. Once again, thanks for listening and see you next time on the Para Aqua podcast.